You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Hello, this is Ian with Toilet of Hell, and today we're talking with drummer extraordinaire and scion of American metal, Ken Mary. Ken, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
You've had an extraordinary career, but the entry point for our conversation today is your recent work with Flotsam and Jetsam, and you have Blood in the Water coming out this June, is that right?
That is correct. It'll be out June 4th.
Now, I assume you worked on it during the pandemic. Can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, obviously, we've had a lot of friends. We're in Arizona, by the way, which is sort of a ground zero for the pandemic. We had some of the highest cases per capita of anywhere in the world. So I personally know probably 50 people that have had the virus, and some of them, it was serious where they ended up in the hospital for a few days on oxygen. A couple guys in the band got it. One of them, it took about 5 weeks to recover. The other one was sick really badly for about four days. And so we've had a lot of personal experience with it. The singer, AK, his mother was in the hospital for 8 weeks and had a very, you know, severe case. And they didn't think she was going to make it. So, you know, for us during this period, it was, you know, obviously everything was upside down. We knew a lot of people that were getting sick and had a lot of friends that were sick. We knew a few people peripherally, you know, I mean, friends, you know, we had friends die, not in Arizona, but in different states. And so, you know, it's a tragedy for sure. And it's a tragedy for so many people. And that definitely affected the mood of the record for sure.
I'm really sorry to hear that. That's incredibly difficult to deal with. And were you working together in person at all? Or was this, you're working in your home studio, sending files back and forth? I know a lot of folks I've talked with have been doing their albums that way.
Well, we sort of had to, because when we started this process, it was literally, you know, right in the middle of everything. And so it was pretty funny when AK and I were, you know, we tracked all the vocals and drums. You know, a lot of the record was tracked in my studio, because I have like a, you know, it's a real studio with an SSL and, you know, like a studio you think of like in the old days. You know, it's a fully equipped, you know, world-class studio. So we track a lot of stuff there. And so when AK and I did vocals, he would go into the tracking room and I would go into the control room, and we'd never see each other except through the glass. So you know, we were trying to do our best to keep our family safe. Like, I have a mother, and she's 81 now, and AK's mom is in her 80s too. And so we were trying to keep our family safe. And you know, for the most part, I mean, with the exception of, you know, like I told you, AK's mother did get sick. His dad, you know, who was around his mother, had no symptoms at all. You know, and he's in the same age group and didn't have any problem with it. So it was a very weird, it seems like it just affected different people in different ways. But anyways, back to your question, we did start out definitely just, you know, it was all Skype. It was sending files. It was working in the studio, but in different rooms and with different air conditioning and trying to, you know, keep our families as safe as possible.
I want to talk about your studio with the SSL board. And I like that you called it a studio. Like, you, what do you say? A studio like you think they used to be, or.
Yeah. You know, well, it's funny, 'cause you know, we have, sometimes we'll have people from different recording programs, like Mesa Community College will bring their class over, and they'll show, you know, we'll go through the equipment and I'll show them, you know, how we record some things and what the process is like. And I always tell them, you know, this is the studio that was built on yesteryear's business. You know, this is not like, if you were going to walk into a studio today, you're probably going to see like a computer, some outboard gear, you know, maybe a room that you track in. I mean, it's a completely different animal than, you know, the racks of outboard gear and a massive analog console and all these different things that, you know, there's not as much use for today. I mean, I personally like them because I think they sound the best. I mean, I think analogs to me sounds much better than digital. But, you know, all that being said, digital has come a long way and you can do a tremendous amount with digital too.
Were you tracking digital for the new Flotsam and Jetsam, or were you going to tape for some of that?
Well, we definitely tracked digital. It all went to Pro Tools HD. I'm trying to remember the, I mean, this is not important for your your listeners, but.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Really? Okay. Well, we did it, I think, at 88.2 kilohertz, which is like a, it's a faster speed for, it's more data for the digital, basically. And so it was all digital, but, you know, on the flip side, you know, we're running through all kinds of analog processing. Like when AK sings into a mic, it's a, you know, it's a Neumann U87, which is like about a $4,000 mic going into Vintec preamp and EQ unit, which is another couple thousand dollars going into a TubeTech vocal compressor, which is another, you know, $3,000, and then into some high-end analog to digital conversion. So by the time, you know, he's running through a ton of analog gear before it ever gets to digital, which is part of the magic too. I mean, I think the more analog you can get into the process, into the recording process, the better it's going to sound.
Oh yeah. And talk about how studios can compete with that. You know, everybody's got a little something they can record with at home, but they don't all have $30,000 worth of microphones on the input side of that.
No, I mean, that's a very important, you know, aspect of it is the microphones and the preamps and the compression. And, you know, when you have real gear, I mean, it does make a difference, and it brings your, you know, I just think if you have two engineers that are equal in skill, and you give one better gear, well, that, you know, it's going to sound better. So, you know, obviously the engineer is very important too. You can have great gear and you can have somebody that doesn't know what they're doing, and it's not going to really help that much. So I think it's the ear first and foremost. And then after that, it's the gear. So.
And where are you at with guitar plugins, amp simulators? I know plenty of, well-known engineers who are starting to say, you know, I don't want to record a real amp ever again. These amp simulators are perfect.
Well, you know, specifically, you know, we have used a tremendous amount of that. Nowadays, with a Kemper, I don't know if you're familiar with that amplifier, but Kemper sort of changed the whole business a little bit. If you look at, like, I have friends in Accept, you know, Wolf Hoffman's a friend of mine, and I asked him years ago, like probably about 5 years ago, he was starting to use the Kemper, and I said, well, you know, because I'm an old school engineer. I like a microphone. I like a cabinet. You know, I want air to be moved, you know, to create the sound. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, you're using that amp model or the Kemper, you know, what do you think about it? He goes, it's amazing. And you won't believe it till you hear it. And I was thinking to myself, well, if Wolf feels that way about it, then there's got to be something to it. So, you know, we checked it out, and then, you know, the guys in Flotsam ended up getting the Kempers, and we used them live, and we've used them in the studio. And, you know, that's an amp modeling, you know, it's basically an amp modeling computer is basically what it is. And it's very high tech. And, you know, if somebody would have told me the process, you know, basically you put a mic in front of your real guitar cabinet and your real amplifier head, and then it runs some tones through, and then it basically can emulate whatever amp you model into it. And to me, you know, I mean, it almost seems like witchcraft, you know. It's like, how is it doing that? I have no idea, but the bottom line is it does sound, to my ear, it sounds very good. I think, you know, to those engineers out there, if you model the amp with a little bit more high end on it so that you can, if anything, if you have to roll the high end off, you're better off. Because I think if you do have to roll high end into the guitar tracks, that's when it starts sounding like you can kind of tell that there's a little bit of a digital thing going on there. But I think as long as you don't have to add high end to it, it's very powerful in terms of, you know, it sounds great, and you just plug a cable in and you're done. And it is pretty amazing. And, you know, you're not moving the microphone all over the cab and trying all these different things like we used to in the old days, setting up five mics and, you know, doing all this crazy stuff. I mean, you know, you just plug a cable in and you're done.
No, but you do wind up scrolling through an awful lot of presets. That might be the curse of working digitally.
Sure. Well, there is that. I mean, now you have access to, you know, like I think Steve has like, you know, 1,000 amps in his camp, you know, so something like that. But we do have our favorites. You know, there's like a couple where, you know, you just go, okay, this works and it's a great sound. And we use it in conjunction with this other amp for overdubs. And so you start developing your favorites. And so, you know, usually it's a fairly fast process.
So let's rewind to some of your earliest studio experiences. I personally am a huge fan of Fifth Angel, and I'd love to hear about what those early Fifth Angel sessions were like, especially considering, you know, how different things are today.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if you really want to talk about that, I mean, it was an incredible experience. Fifth Angel was my first real record, and it was also the first real record for a producer named Terry Date. And I don't know if you know who that is, but Terry went on to produce Soundgarden and Deftones and Limp Bizkit and, I mean, platinum after platinum album. And so this
was before that.
Oh, this is before all of that. This is 1985, and this is pre-grunge in Seattle, and this is pre-Metal Church. I think Metal Church was his second album that he ever recorded. So it's really, I think he ended up doing like Mother Love Bone, that album. I mean, he did a ton of records out of the Seattle area. He's certainly one of the premier producers from Seattle. But that was his first record, and we were all super young and just learning about things, and we were goofing around. We'd be going like, oh, hey, let's try, you know, Exciter on the cymbals, and let's try compressing the overall mix. And, you know, the interesting thing was we kind of learned a lot of things together, and Terry had, you know, he definitely had talent. You know, he had some natural ability, and I think along with our experimentation, you know, I think it was a big growing part, big growing process for everyone. Like, everyone really learned a great deal from doing that record. And one thing that carried with me through my entire lifetime, was that if you do something with excellence, it holds up forever. And the funny thing about those Fifth Angel albums, I don't know if you know this, but they were re-released by Metal Blade like 2 years ago. So, you know, these are albums that are, you know, 35 years old or whatever, well, 34 years old. I'm trying to remember when that came out. I think it was 1986 or 7. And then I think the second one was 1988. But those records were done, you know, all analog. There was no digital. There was no, you know, hey, if the vocal is out of pitch, you can fix it. If the drumming was out of time, you can use Beat Detective. Like, none of that stuff existed. So if you couldn't play it or sing it, it didn't end up on the record. And so we're very proud of those records. I go back and listen to those, and they're so well crafted. And that was because we really cared, and we really wanted to make something great. We really wanted to make great art. And looking back, I kind of go like, you know, we really did achieve that for our time period. You know, those albums, I mean, for being as young as we were and having the limited budget that we had, it's actually, I still am very impressed with it even today.
So am I. The tightness on it, to know that it wasn't the result of digital surgery. You hear other albums of the era from similar metal bands who I won't name, and, you know, they sound like kids in their first time in the studio, but that first Fifth Angel record is tight as can be and still, you know, meets a modern sensibility. Were you just going in that rehearsed, or were you learning about how to tighten it up as you were recording it?
Well, the band was extremely tight to begin with. I mean, it was a band that, you know, we rehearsed all the time, and, you know, we really were good at our craft. And I think part of the thing was, you know, in that era, you know, if you listen to the drum tracks from that time, you know, it's not super complex. I mean, it's fairly simple drum parts because that was the style. I mean, the big bands were, you know, Iron Maiden, AC/DC, Judas Priest. You know, those were the kind of influences that we had. And, you know, those drum parts are not terribly complex. And so, you know, when we did this, we definitely, solidity was a very important thing to me personally as a drummer. And so I think part of the reason that those albums are tight is because we did everything to a click track, which back then was, you know, kind of cutting edge. You know, we were doing stuff to the click. I was able to play with it and play with feel and lock to it. Because when I was young and I wanted to get really solid, I bought a drum machine and I spent like a year just, you know, learning how to lock onto it and then learn how to play along with the drum machine, but have feel to it. And that served me really well. When I lived in LA, I used to get all kinds of studio work replacing some drummers that you would know the name of, you know, on session work, because producers would call me and go, hey, we need a good feel. This all has to be done to a click. You know, can you come in and do it? And back then you couldn't fix anything. So I used to get paid a lot of money to ghost on stuff and to, you know, to play on records. And that was all going back to that first Fifth Angel album. You know, that's where we really honed our craft. We got good in the studio. And it's something that we paid a lot of attention to, and it was a great learning process. And again, I carried it that experience and those lessons pretty much through to to life itself. You know, you could apply that to anything in life. Do it with excellence. Whatever you're going to do, make it amazing, make it great, and it will stand the test of time.
So, what was going on in Seattle recording Fifth Angel that got you down to Hollywood?
Well, I had been touring with another artist, a guy named Randy Hansen, who still is out touring today. He does a Hendrix tribute. And I was playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go, and some people from Alice Cooper's management company were at the show, and they were like, hey, you know, we're putting together a new band for Alice. You know, would you like to audition? And, you know, again, I was super young, and I said, well, are you going to fly people down? Because I live in Seattle. And they're like, well, you know, we won't pay for plane flights or anything, but if you want a spot to audition, you know, we'll hold a spot for you. And so they did. And I came in, and then the next thing I knew, I was, you know, living in LA and on tour with Alice, playing in front of, you know, 20,000 people, and you know, live on MTV, and you know, just so many crazy experiences with that. I mean, that was such an amazing time, because there is nothing like your first time of doing something like that. You know, there's certainly times, you know, I was in House of Lords later and other bands, and you know, played big shows and did big tours and that kind of thing, but nothing was as much fun, in my opinion, as that, you know, that first time was something special, because you know, you just, the biggest place I'd played before Alice was about 3,000 seater, the Paramount Theater in Seattle, Washington. And then all of a sudden I was playing, you know, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000, 22,000, 40,000 at the Reading Festival. I mean, all of a sudden I was playing these massive gigs, and it was, you know, being as young as we were, and, you know, it was a amazing time for music. And the crowds were just incredible in the 80s. I mean, they were just there to have fun. They had a great time, and it really was an incredible era for music.
At the time, you're out there with Fifth Angel, Alice Cooper, but also, and I feel like I'm hallucinating, but Jesse and the Rippers, is that right?
Well, that was a little later. That was in 92, I think, or 93. Actually, it might have been 93. Yeah, maybe it was 93 or 94. I honestly can't remember. But yeah, I was actually on 3 episodes of Full House. And that's a funny story too, because if you think about it, at the time it was the number one television show in the entire United States, and I was the drummer in Jesse and the Rippers for 3 episodes. Actually, the very important episodes. There was a thing called Prom Night. There was a It was an episode called Captain Video, where his video was, you know, being played on MTV, and I was in the video, and we're, you know, playing with the Beach Boys and everything. I mean, it was really incredible. And then we did a season finale at Disney World in Florida, and that was another just incredible experience. So you're not hallucinating. It was a little bit later, but yeah, I was actually in Jesse and the Rippers.
But how?
How did that happen? Well, that's kind of an interesting story. John Stamos is friends with Lanny Cordola, the guitar player, the first guitar player in House of Lords. And he had seen us play at, I'm trying to remember the name, and I think it was the Palace in Los Angeles. It's a theater, I think it's like a 2,000 or 2,500 seat theater. And John Stamos is a drummer as well. Like, he'll go and tour and play drums for the Beach Boys. And, you know, he just saw me play, and he was like, he talked to Lanny. He goes, man, I want that guy on my show. You know, that guy's like a great player. You know, can he come down and be on the show? And, you know, it was a incredible experience doing that too. So I was like, absolutely, I can do that. So it was a lot of fun actually. And John was incredible to work with, you know, super nice guy. And he tried to give me this is a bit of trivia, but he tried to give me a shout out on national television. I did this like little drum roll in this skit that they were doing. And he goes, thank you, Kenny. And so, you know, he gave me like a call out on national TV, and the producers, he did it every single take to make sure it would get in there, and the producers edited it out. So, but at least, you know, I thought that was so cool of him to try to get my name on national television, you know, because again, it was the number one show in the entire U.S. I want to say the viewing audience was something like, you know, 40 million people or something, which is funny because more people saw me on that show than probably anything else, you know, because it was, you know, it was such a big show.
I was in the audience for it, and I can't quite stitch together in my mind that I would watch. I probably saw you on that show and then went and jammed out to some Fifth Angel and never
put the two together. Well, that's funny because I'll get calls from friends even today, you know, like, hey, yeah, I just saw you, you know, there's a rerun of, you know, that episode or whatever. And I just saw you on Full House, you know, I'll get texts and stuff. So it's pretty funny, but yeah, what a great experience. I mean, it was a blast.
I want to return to Seattle, or at least your Seattle roots. When you were talking about Terry Date and how he went on to do all these big grunge albums, when I talk to bands of your era, artists of your era, one thing that they all come back to is how disruptive grunge was for metal and how disruptive that was for their careers. But I've never talked to somebody who was from the Seattle metal scene. So you must have had a really unique take on what was going on with this new rebranding of the Seattle sound and grunge and metal's over. What was that like from your perspective?
Well, I think it was very unfortunate, to be honest with you. I think it was a horrible era, and here's why. I mean, and anybody can go ahead and dispute me on this, but there was a backlash against metal in the United States. Now, what's funny is that didn't happen in Europe. In Europe, you know, I mean, metal is still king, and it never left. And grunge, grunge didn't really take off in Europe. But in the United States, for whatever reason, it turned into an either or. Like, you either were grunge or you were metal. You couldn't be, you know, you couldn't like both. And that to me was a stupid time, because basically it pushed out all these amazing metal bands, and they had to either go to Europe or die. And, you know, and you kind of look at it and you go, you know, grunge lasted what, like 2 years, 3 years? And then it was on to, you know, Sheryl Crow and NSYNC and, you know, everything else. I mean, you look at all the stuff that happened after that, you know, it lasted like 2 years or 3 years. There were like three big bands. There was Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam. And you go, you know, and it totally just, you know, basically everybody went into, you know, they were exiled, you know, pretty much to, you know, you couldn't really do anything in the United States. I think it was really horrible, because if you think about it, there's never been a backlash like that except for the disco era. There was a time in the late 70s or early 80s when there used to be things, you know, they'd have record burning parties. You can go look on YouTube and see, like, you know, burning disco records at, you know, some stadium. I think it might have been Shea Stadium or something. They had a disco sucks day, and everybody burned their disco albums. And I'm kind of going, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. You know, if you look at music history, like, nothing's ever happened like that before. I mean, it was disco, and then if it was metal, then, you know, you suck and you're out of here. And it was like, I mean, there's a lot of super talented bands that went through a really tough period. I mean, even bands like Metallica, you know, they went through a very rough period in the 90s, and Megadeth as well. You know, those are good friends of mine. And, you know, they had a very tough time going into the 90s. And, you know, it eventually rectified itself. But I think it was an unfortunate era, because it should never be it's either this or this. It should always be like inclusive. I think it was a non-inclusive musical era. How's that?
Go to Europe or die is a pretty good bumper sticker for the whole thing.
It was pretty much go to Europe or die. Yep.
What do you think makes the European situation so different that they just I mean, other than they didn't like grunge, I mean, metal in general is of a really different stature culturally in Western Europe, at least, than it is here. Do you have any take on why that might be?
Well, I just think that it speaks to the people. You know, I think for whatever reason, you know, they have connected with that music in a way that is different than the United States. I can't tell you why. I think that there is some corporate influence in this, and I will say this, that I think if you look at what the corporations push in the United States versus what the corporations push in Europe, I think it's different. And so I think here, you know, if you look at our culture, it's predominantly rap and pop, and there's really no metal to speak of. I mean, there's some underground stuff, you know, there's Five Finger Death Punch, which, you know, you kind of go like, okay, it's sort of like a, you know, it's more of a commercial metal. But there's some bands that have taken off that are underground completely, you know, stuff like Ghost, stuff like, you know, Rammstein will play, you know, a sold out Coliseum here. But you'll never hear them on the radio. You'll never hear them, you know, on anything. You can go see them on YouTube. And, you know, but that's a problem, I think. Like, if you think about that, like, why is there a type of music that's being, you know, basically ostracized in the United States? I don't understand it. And I don't think it's good for music. And I think that it's going to be a matter of time before metal just explodes in this country, because it's been kept under wraps for like 30 years. I just don't think it's going to be kept under wraps for much longer.
No, I'm with you. It has to have something to do with industry priorities. It's clear that metal is not a priority, especially for what's going on with the American side of promotions. But we're also talking about, you know, the big labels are multinationals. So it's incredible that they could have part of their portfolio marketed differently in Europe compared to having almost no support in the States.
Well, here's a good example. There's a band called Arch Enemy, I'm sure you're familiar with, and they'll play, you know, in front of 500,000 people in South America, and they'll play a big festival in Europe in front of, you know, 200,000 people, and they'll come to the United States and play, you know, House of Blues, you know, and you go, okay, what's going on? You know, somebody should be looking at that going, well, if it's huge all over the world, but it's not huge here, why isn't somebody going like, hey, I need to invest in this and make this successful over here? And to me, that just says everything, that there's, in my opinion, there's a desire on the part of the corporations to not have metal succeed in the United States. That's my opinion. I don't have any real, you know, I don't have anything in terms of proof to back that up, but it sure seems to me that, look, if something's huge all over the world, why wouldn't you bring it here and make it huge here? And nobody's doing that. And you go, well, there's money involved. Why isn't that happening? And then you kind of have to go, yeah, that seems a little odd. It seems a little non-free market to me. Like, it seems like that's something that's you know, there is something going on that's causing that to be, you know, metal is not as mainstream as it should be, because you can't have something that's that huge and that influential all over the world and then go to one country and it's non-existent. You know, it's just, there's something going on. But anyways, that's a deep well, so we should probably go to something else.
Yeah, it's hard not to get conspiratorial about it, but I'm with you on that.
Well, so I don't think you can avoid it. I mean, I think if you look at the facts, I mean, it's hard not to get conspiratorial about it. I'm just looking at it going, it could be a factor. You know, I don't know what the exact reasons are, but why isn't anyone putting money into it when it's huge everywhere else? It doesn't make any sense from an economic standpoint. So, and we'll probably find out someday, but not today, apparently.
That and UFOs. I'm still waiting.
Well, they said UFOs exist. So, I mean, that was funny because during COVID, you know, basically the military came out and said, yeah, they're UFOs. And everybody's like, yeah, anyways, what's for lunch? You know, like nobody paid attention at all. It was pretty funny.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk to you about your recording studio. What is it? Sonic Fish?
Sonic Fish Productions, yep.
I was having a look at it, and it's really interesting to me. It looks like you're pretty well involved in the Christian contemporary music scene, which again is just about as surprising as Jesse and the Rippers, I think. Can you speak to what your involvement with that is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was, you know, the whole business, you know, I will say this, that the studio in terms of its focus and what we've been producing over the years has changed considerably. I mean, we used to be probably 80% music and 20% we would be doing other projects like maybe, you know, movies or film or audiobooks or whatever it is. And, you know, now we're definitely, that's completely reversed. You know, we're probably doing 20% music and 80% of things like audiobooks and film. Like right now we're very involved in film and television, audio soundtracks, even things for like animated movies where we'll do all the Foley, which I don't know if your listeners know what that is, but that's basically where you, you know, you're actually putting in all the sound effects that you see on an animated movie. Like if somebody opens a door, you have to put that in. If somebody walks, you have to put that in because there's no natural sound. So all that has to be done. So all that to say is, you know, our focus is definitely different, but we had a period of about, I'd say probably about 10 years where we did a tremendous amount of recordings for the CBA market. And we had a good deal of success there too. So we had some great artists that we produced and did well. But yeah, we did numerous recordings in that market. I'm going to say to the tune of probably, you know, I'd have to guess, but I'd say probably maybe 30 or more records.
That's incredible. The similarities between Christian music and metal are sort of, I think we were just talking about, you would never know how big a fandom, how many artists, how much money is flowing through something like metal or something like Christian contemporary music until you get involved in that scene.
Sure. Well, you know, it used to be a very thriving scene. I mean, and just like the, you know, the interesting thing is the entire music business is different. And you can tell because what I just said, where, you know, 80% of what we used to do was music and now it's, you know, 20%. The money to record is no longer there. I mean, it's with streaming. I mean, streaming has really eaten away into record company profits and artist profits, and making money off of the actual music these days is an extremely difficult thing to do. So, you know, I just think it's part of the, you know, it's part of it is a, you know, it's just a sign of the change in the music business. Like I can go back and I can go like, okay, if I look back at the studio's career and I go, okay, in 2003, we opened the room with the SSL. That, you know, we moved to Mesa and we turned that into a, you know, a world-class facility. And at that time, iTunes had just come out in 2000, and it really hadn't impacted the industry yet. And then as iTunes took hold, like really around, I'd say probably 2005 to 2008, there was a different business model. And we went to, instead of selling a whole record, you sell one song. And instead of making $12 a record, you're making, you know, a dollar a download. So, you know, it completely cut revenues by, you know, a massive amount. And then all of a sudden, you know, just when you thought things couldn't get any worse, then YouTube came along and started, you know, everybody started posting music online and everything kind of became free. And then you thought, well, you know, people are still downloading singles. And you know, we had some hit records where we had a song that was very popular. And instead of selling, you know, 400,000 albums, you'd sell 400,000 singles, you know, which is the difference between, you know, making $400,000 gross and making, let's see, you know, like 4 million, you know, plus. So it's just it was just a completely different scale of revenue. And so, you know, now you have, it's even worse because you have streaming where you're getting paid like 0.0002 cents per play or something. And, you know, the revenue's not there. So, you know, I think part of what you're talking about, you know, is the, you know, the change in the actual industry itself. If you look at it on a graph, I mean, it's definitely gone down over the last 20 years. Now, they are saying that streaming, it's, you know, it's kind of bottomed out and it's starting to edge up a little bit. Like the revenues from streaming, you know, are increasing, and, you know, the music business itself is supposed to be increasing in revenue. Now, I don't know who's going to be listening to this interview, but that's probably the kind of stuff that really bores people to tears. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, supposedly the industry is getting somewhat better.
I think people are very interested in hearing this. Don't worry about that. Have you been paying attention to the efforts to have a musicians union?
Well, there always was a musicians union. It's just been, it's just a question of how effective it is. Like, for instance, I'll give you a great example. When we would go do recordings in Nashville, you know, like, because I would go and fly out and engineer recordings there, everybody had to be a member of the musicians union or you couldn't work. You know, if you were doing work for a major label, I mean, that was like a, you know, you it was just part of the deal. And you even had to fill out all the forms. Like, I would have to bring an assistant, and that's all he would do is make sure that everybody was a member of the union and all the forms were filled out and everybody was paid scale and, you know, all of these different requirements that they had. So Nashville at the time, and we're talking early part of the 2000s, you had to actually abide by the rules, and there were, you know, it was a strong union. And then, you know, you could go to LA and it was completely the opposite. You know, you could pay whatever and nobody had to be part of the union, and you just did your studio work. And, you know, I did tons and tons of major label albums. I never saw a union form, you know, in the entire time I lived in Los Angeles. So it really was kind of a zip code dependent power or entity. And I think that, you know, as time has gone on, I think it's become less and less powerful because of the advent of home studios. You know, a lot of people are just doing recordings in their bedrooms, you know, on a laptop. And so with that being the case, you know, the unions just don't have, you know, the musicians union does not have the power that it used to have. So I don't know if that's ever going to come back, I guess is what I'm saying, but.
Yeah, the union effort I was talking about is the Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, which is more for independent artists that are trying to organize for a fairer share of streaming. So if you haven't checked it out, you should definitely check it out, because it's sort of an alternative to completely disorganized free labor, which seems to be what the music industry relies on.
Well, there's some bands trying some new approaches, too. I can't remember what band it was, but they're putting out... they're trying to use blockchain technology to give fans, you know, an option to have some increased interaction and increased product, basically for, you know, an increase in payment. So we'll see how successful that model is and if it changes the business. But I think one of the big issues with the business right now compared to the business of yesteryear is, you know, you're really forced to make your entire revenue stream from live recording and merchandise, as opposed to making anything off of the actual music itself. And that's very unfortunate for young artists and new artists. And, you know, if you're established and you had a great career, you know, it's not going to really affect you that much. But if you're new and upcoming, you know, how are you going to do this if you can't, you know, afford to eat? You know, it makes it a little difficult. So, you know, it is unfortunate, and I do hope it changes.
Yeah, I suppose if you want to have a job selling t-shirts and hot sauce, you should probably just skip the learning to play music part and just start selling t-shirts and hot sauce.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, back in the day, though, you've seen some serious advances for recording with Magdalene. Is this right? A quarter of $1 million?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, back in the day, I was in House of Lords. We spent $230,000 on our second album. And I'm trying to, that would be, let me go to an inflation calculator online. And I'll tell you what that would actually be today. I'm going to guess that that's probably like spending like $500,000 in recording today would be my guess. But let's see how accurate I am. But, you know, yeah, the budgets were just completely different because, well, there's a couple of factors. I think one of the factors was it used to be much more expensive to record an album. I mean, when you think about it, you used to have to be in a studio like mine where, you know, you would spend $2,000 a day just on the room. And so, you know, that's another thing that has changed. You know, people can do, you know, just like on the new Flotsam album, you know, we're able to record in my studio. We're able to record at home. A lot of the things like guitars, you know, drums, you still have to do in a real studio, of course. And vocals, I think it certainly helps if you can do in a real studio. But there's a lot of, you know, bass, guitars, keyboards, even, you know, you can get away with just working in a small production facility. So that definitely helps, because there's no reason to spend, you know, $230,000 on a record anymore.
No, it really isn't. But now that I've been nice to you, I want to ask you a provocative question.
Okay.
Why do all metal drums sound the same now?
Why do all metal drums sound the same? By the way, I'm looking at the inflation calculator. It looks like 200,000 is about $469,000 or $470,000 in today's money. So
you were just about right.
I was just about right. So why do they all sound the same? I think they sound the same, honestly, because there's a demand for it to sound the same. And what I mean by that is I think it started with Avenged Sevenfold, you know, like there's a lot of augmentation going on with live drums being augmented with samples, and it's a powerful sound. And the reason that it works well in metal is a very difficult genre to make sound good, to mix. And I'm saying this from an engineering perspective. It's difficult when you have these just monster guitars and monster bass and monster vocals, and all of a sudden you're trying to fit the drums in this mess. And to make them pop, a lot of times you have to augment the live drums with samples to really get some consistency and make it so that it actually cuts through the wall of guitars that's going on. And so I think that that's really one of the factors. I think it just sounds better. The mixes sound better with a little bit of that augmentation. And it's something that I think the consumer obviously has made the choice, you know, where, you know, they like the sound of that to a large degree as well. So I really think that it's just a question of, you know, where you can actually hear what the drummer's doing. I don't think it's intentional where everybody's going, hey, we want all our drums to sound the same. I just think that they're, you know, we're trying to get a drum sound that can cut through this monster wall of instrumentation. And that's really, you know, in my opinion, it's very tough to do. It's one of the almost only ways to do it. So that's why you hear a lot of similarity in metal drum sounds.
And it's a vicious cycle, right? Can't change up the drum sound because we can't change up the guitar timbres. So as long as we're going to have this big wall of stereo guitars, we're going to be stuck with these clicky drum sounds. So that, you know, the
well, audience is funny is that, you know, you talked about going and listening to some of those albums, you know, besides Fifth Angel, and you go like, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, you can kind of tell the production doesn't sound that good. And, you know, it's part of, you know, the sonics, how it sounds to your ear is very important. And I just think it's a much more difficult process. Like, I think it probably could be done. But the other thing that we're fighting with is budgets. You know, like everybody's, you know, trying to record a whole album now. Like, you know, we talked about the budgets back in the day, which would be the equivalent of $500,000. And now budgets are, you know, well under, depending on who the artist is, but, you know, generally in that, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 area, which is 1/10 of what it was, you know, back in, you know, 25 years ago. So when you think about that, you go, well, you know, how are you going to do that and do this quickly and make it all sound good and get it together? And so people are using some of the technology that's available today to do that. I don't think there's really anything wrong with that as long as the playing is real. You know, like if you're augmenting something that's, you know, real performance, that's one thing. If you're having to, you know, completely just edit the living tar out of it so it's not even the drummer anymore, then that's a whole different, you know, animal. And that does happen, and I've heard that on records too.
Yeah, it does have a sound to it. I think one thing that there is to be said for the current standard of big metal production is, for me as a listener anyway, I can focus more on the song, the composition, the lyrics, all of that. But part of what I like about independent underground metal is just the, you know, sometimes the bonkers mixes, the bizarre guitar tones, you know, things that, and so in those cases, I'm often not even paying attention to whether or not they're writing an interesting song. I'm just entranced by this guitar sound that I don't hear very often.
Sure.
What's an up and coming thing that maybe our listeners haven't heard that you're interested in right now that you think more people should be checking out?
Well, I mean, I hate to even bring the band up because they're not really underground. I mean, they're kind of, you know, killing it right now. They're one of the biggest metal bands, I think, at least in the U.S., but a band called Gojira, you know, and they're, you know, the guitars are tuned down. And I like it because I'm not a huge fan of, you know, the vocals where every singer sounds exactly the same. I mean, you should ask me that question because, you know, when you think about it, you know, how many metal vocalists sound exactly the same where you can't distinguish, you know, like, and I'm kind of going as a fan, well, why would you like one band over this other band? Like, is it their artwork? Because they sound exactly the same. I mean, there's really no difference. Like, what did you like about this band versus this band? Cause I can't tell them apart musically. So,
can't tell the artwork apart a lot of times.
Well, yeah, there you go. So, yeah, now I forgot what the question was.
I think I did too. We got sidetracked on metal vocalists all sound the same. Oh no, Gojira. We're talking about Gojira.
Yes, that band. You know, the reason I like them is because they have a little bit of that, like, rawr, you know, it's got the vocals kind of has the growl, but he's also got a little bit of melody in there. And I like the drummer. Like, you know, he, you know, reminds me a little bit of myself, you know, just because, you know, he seems real solid and he seems like he cares about, you know, the timing and everything. Like, he seems like he's real, like a precision oriented player, which I like a lot. I love the guitars in the music. It's just a band, you know, you said, what am I checking out? I mean, you know, like I said, they've been around for a long time actually. And I think they're very powerful, in terms of the musical delivery. Like, I enjoy listening to it, and some of the songs are super catchy. So that's one of the things that I've kind of, you know, been enjoying, I guess. I've been enjoying the fact that they're starting to really make an impact in the United States as well. And they're from France, you know, which is an interesting anomaly. You know, there's not a lot of French metal bands that you can think of that are big in the United States.
No, not at all. So let's wrap up here and talk about what's going to be happening with Flotsam and Jetsam going on through 2021. You have a tour coming out 2022 with Accept, is that right?
That is true. That's on the books. I mean, from what we understand, you know, we're in close contact with the agents and you know, that is correct. You know, everybody is, of course, you know, with everything, everybody's taking, you know, a kind of wait and see. You know, we certainly hope that all of those things are going to happen. Now, you know, in the United States here, we have big tours that are supposed to be happening this summer. So we're talking about maybe doing a short run in the U.S. this summer, maybe 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. We'll see. You know, that's something that we're considering. We're just taking a very careful look to see, you know, what the attendance is of the events that do go on, because, you know, you do have to make, you know, for us, you know, just like most artists, we have to make our money off the ticket sales and merchandise. And if your audience is cut in half because, you know, people don't want to go to shows yet, you know, we're just watching that very carefully.
Well, I wish you all the best and safest of tours when that happens. I know a lot of us are really dying to see concerts again, and it's wait and see, right?
Well, we are too. You know, we miss our fans, you know, especially in Europe. I mean, you know, we had a year of dates canceled. You know, it was something that was not easy. And, you know, when you talk about the Flotsam album and, you know, the attitude that went into it, I mean, that really has a lot to do with it, because, you know, it was an upsetting time. You know, it's an upsetting time for so many artists. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, basically you can't do your art anymore, you know? And so that's why we ran in and did a record, because, you know, we had to have some sort of outlet for what was going on. And, you know, we'll see what happens. We certainly hope that we're going to get back to touring sooner rather than later, but I guess, you know, we're going to see what happens. Hopefully that'll be the case.
Fingers crossed. Well, Ken, is there anything you'd like to add before we part ways today?
Yeah, just to all your listeners that are fans, we just want to thank, we always want to thank our fans because, you know, honestly, you know, we've met so many on our tours and they're just the greatest people. You know, we love them. They love us. And it's a really cool thing. You know, our fans are a little bit special. And when I say special, I mean, they're just cool people, you know? And, so I just want to thank those that are out there that are listening, that are fans of the band and that come see us play. And certainly, we'll always do our best to, you know, to make sure that we're holding up our end of the bargain.
Well, we love you too, Ken. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks so much. You have a great day.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.